in the assignment. Everybody's done? Cool.
Okay, tonight, talking about the relationship between our sort of mental health and our physical health. So the connection between psychology and our physical health. Psychology has a whole area just called health psychology. You can specialize once you have, you know, your graduate degree in psychology, you can specialize in health psychology. So a lot of study goes into this particular area. This we're going to skip, and we're going to start here. You got to write down that whole definition if I remember correctly. This is from the World Health Organization. World Health Organization trying to define what is health. We put this definition into effect in 1948. They haven't changed it since. Health? Health is a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. Infirmity generally just means weakness. A lot of people think that if they don't have a sickness, that they're well. And this definition clearly says that that's not the case. That we need to consider a lot of different factors, because many things contribute to our health, not just our physical being, but also our mental and social well-being. And that just because you don't have the flu doesn't mean that you're well. How many of you know someone right now who is not sick? Well, they're not in very good shape. I mean, there's lots of examples of that. Alternatively, you know some folks who, even though they're ill at the time, they tend to stay pretty upbeat and positive, and they're physically in pretty good shape. So that's what this definition was trying to get at. And like I said, they haven't changed it. So they're really sticking with this one. We're going to look at that combination of mental and physical tonight. I told you already, health psychology. Whole field of psychology that looks at the relationship between our mental and our physical health. There's all sorts of areas that health psychology dabbles in. It looks at, how do we promote good health? How do we help people maintain their present health? How do we help them improve their health? How can we improve the healthcare system? All of these things are part of health psychology. Health psychology looks at interesting things like, why do some people follow medical advice and why do some people ignore medical advice? How many smokers say, yeah, I know that it's bad for me, and they just keep doing it? How many of you have a prescription? You've been going through medicine cabinet, whatever, and you find a prescription that's half taken. And it says very clearly on the bottle, take until finished. Your doctor, when the doctor prescribed, said take this until it's gone. How come you didn't?
I felt better.
Yeah, but they said very clearly. If the doctor had said, take this until you feel better and then stop, that'd have been cool. Why did you just unilaterally decide that? Right? Why don't people follow medical advice? That's something that health psychology is interested in. Health psychology is also interested in the connection between how you think and whether or not that can actually cause physical problems. Is there a way that you can think that will create a physical ailment? And the answer is absolutely. Now, a lot of people refer to that as psychosomatic, It's not really the term we use anymore, but that's what you may know it as. In psychology, we refer to them specifically as somatoform disorders, where psychological ill health can cause physical problems. That's a pretty interesting thing to study. And when we talk about stress, which we get into next time, when we talk about stress, a lot of you probably already know from personal experience that when you get really, really stressed out, physically, it wears on you. You get tired, you feel run down, right? You get tension. And sometimes when you're stressed out, right about the time things seem like they might start getting better, you get sick. It's like, what? Come on, I was getting better. We'll talk about that relationship next time, but that's health psychology. And in health psychology, we talk about the holistic approach. Seems like a big deal, but guess what? It's really very straightforward. Holistic approach. Mind and body go together. You can't divorce the two. So when we're talking about somebody's overall health or wellness, we tend to approach it from this holistic idea or approach. Have a look at mind and body. If you've had the flu, you know that psychologically you start feeling kind of run down. Tired, no energy, you just don't feel good. And it's not just, yeah, okay, you're throwing up or maybe you got a respiratory thing going on, whatever it is. Hey, you're just out of it. If I gave you something that you really had to concentrate on, you're not going to be able to. When I ask you to get really excited about something, you're not going to be able to. Why? Because your physical body says, this sucks, and your mind follows. I mean, it's hard to feel good mentally when you're physically ill. Flip that over. When you're mentally ill in some way, so let's say you're suffering from a depression, right? Some of the diagnostic criteria for depression include physical symptoms like fatigue and lethargy, right? And changes in your sleep pattern, your eating patterns. Those two things are linked.
Why would you say mind and body go together? You can't separate the two, because sometimes when your body, like you're saying, like when your body is ill, like your mind wishes that it would get better, but you know, like if something happens to you that's out of your control in your mind, you're thinking, gosh, I wish this was opposite of what's happening, but it
doesn't happen. Sure, right. I mean, just you can't necessarily just will yourself into being well. I mean, if you catch some sort of disease or something, you can't oftentimes will it away. However, there are some folks who are very religious who believe that yes, you can. Right? That just the strength and power of your belief can make a difference. But you're right, we can't just wish things into being sometimes. This is a made-up word. In psychology, where we make things up. We make up words. Biopsychosocial. That's us being lazy. It's our way of saying, well, if we're going to look at health, we need to consider biological factors. We need to consider psychological factors. We need to consider sociological and sociocultural factors. In other words, we've got to consider everything. The biopsychosocial model is actually the basis for our diagnostic manual. Our whole system of understanding the different psychological problems that are out there are based on this biopsychosocial model, which is just our recognition of, you know what? Some psychological problems have a biological cause. Some psychological problems really are just psychological. And some psychological problems relate to our circumstances, what's going on around us. And some of them are a combination of all three things. So it's us covering our bases and saying that in trying to determine a person's health, there are many things that we have to consider. An example. Some of the things we're going to cover tonight, too. If we were going to look at the biological end of things, we might talk about your family tree. How many of you know, I've probably asked you this before, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, these things run in families, Well, depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, learning disorders, ADHD, all this stuff. It can run in families. There's a genetic component to much of this stuff. So that's the biology. I'm going to divert from the biopsychosocial just for a second and talk about the environment itself, pathogens. A school is a great example of this. Schools are disease incubators. Hi, welcome to this disease incubator. I'm your host, Troy DeVore. Coughing and sneezing and hacking and peeing on yourself and not washing your hands drives me nuts. I'm going to digress just for a second. Related to this, do we really need signs in the bathroom to tell us how to wash our hands? Have we devolved that far?
Yes.
We're that stupid? Really? Wash your frickin' hands. Come on. It's not that tough. Right? You miss that day in elementary school? Did your parents just drop the ball completely? Come on. Right? Well, we got pathogens in the environment. There are diseases and toxins and stuff out there. When you sneeze and hack all over yourself, wash your hands. The behavioral risk factors, we're going to talk about some of those tonight. That has a lot to do with choice, which has a lot to do with psychology. So we'll spend some time there. And then the social, a lot of people don't think of this initially. But let's just use food and eating as an example. Our social and cultural customs are absolutely relevant, right? A lot of our social and family activities revolve around meals. They revolve around food. We have rituals around food, right? Thanksgiving, great example. What are you going to do? Load up on food and go to sleep. It's just what you do. You load up on food and drink, you go to sleep. We have all-you-can-eat buffets where everybody can go and just pig out. Your money's worth, but not your health's worth. And then what is this? How many of you come from a family where, you know, 7, 8 in the morning, it's breakfast time. Noon is lunchtime. And 5, 6 o'clock is dinner time. Who the hell made that up? Right? Any ideas where that came from? The reality of work and school schedules. Right? And that's completely arbitrary. We've stopped listening to our bodies when it says, hey, you know, I'm hungry. Why? Breakfast, lunch, dinner. That's just silly, right? But we do it because of scheduling. That is a sort of sociocultural factor. That's a ritual around food, and it's arbitrary and imposed. Listen to your body, you'll probably eat better. What we're going to talk a lot about tonight has to do with this idea of choice. And when we talk about health, really what we're talking about is an overall sort of process of self-care that we call wellness. The most important point here is that we need to be individually responsible for the state of our bodies. Yeah, there are genetic things over which we have no control. Yeah, you know, there are diseases that come along and there are side effects from medications and there are other things to consider. But very often, we just make bad choices. So we need to spend a little bit of time talking about those choices. Wellness, as it says at the bottom there, a lifelong process of self-care. It's not a fad diet. So we're talking about a lifelong process of self-care. We'll look at some of those choices that we make. Here's a good example of misinformation. A lot of people think that, well, if you have chicken, you're healthier. Not when you bread it and fry it and slather it with mayo. You're completely defeating the purpose. It's like having a Caesar salad. The dressing defeats the purpose of the healthy green stuff. You ever check the fat content in Caesar dressing? It's awful. Right? Oh yeah, and pour it on there and throw a bunch of cheese on there. Oh yeah, there you go. Not it. A lot of people don't know this stuff. Hey, it's just bad information out there and a lot of wives' tales about what's good and what's not. So this is just an FYI. Oh, and by the way, just in case somebody's had a little trouble interpreting this, that doesn't mean that, oh, great, so I can have two hamburgers. And don't do that. Don't. So, in your own experience, honestly, what are some of the things that get in the way of making healthier choices around food? Really?
Time.
Absolutely. Time crunch.
Taste.
Availability, you bet.
Taste.
Money.
Taste.
All true.
Taste.
Yeah.
Like
preferences.
Yeah. Some food tastes better than the other.
Yeah, absolutely. In my world, pizza is the perfect food. Oh, I could be a pizza holic. Morning, noon, night, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter when breakfast, if there's pizza, I'm eating it. I don't care. You could be sitting out all night now. Whatever. Pizza's good food. I've never gone so far as to pick it out of the garbage or anything like that, but I'm telling you. I'm not touching anything else I might consider it. That's a choice. There's nothing biologically in me that says, oh, you know what? It tastes damn good. That's a preference, you bet. It's also very convenient. And just a little insight into my psychology and how I'm a little off. Since I've been an adult and been responsible for taking care of myself, three things that I find to be a huge waste of time: buying food, preparing food, and eating food. That's just the way I think. It's a pain in my ass. Whatever. If it's free and I didn't have to work for it, great. Hey, yeah, I'll come over to your house for dinner. That's super. We having pizza? But I couldn't be bothered. That's just me. Right? That's my being honest about what gets in the way. My own thinking gets in the way. Right? So what are the things that get in our way of making better choices? And then when we make a bad choice, how do we bullshit ourselves into thinking, well, it wasn't that bad? Right? Because that's what, remember, rationalization? When we were talking about personality and Freud and all that stuff, you recall that a rationalization is just us trying to make up an excuse that makes our bad behavior seem okay. So how do we make our bad choices seem better to us? Oh, I worked out this morning, so it won't do as much damage when I snarf down my pizza. And what do we tell ourselves?
Well, I always skipped a couple meals.
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. I'm saying absolutely, I agree that that's one of the things we tell ourselves, not absolutely, that's right, yeah, way to go.
I would say because your hunger feeling's gone and now you're on your tight time criteria.
Sorry, run that by me again, I just wanted to.
Hunger feeling's now gone.
Yep.
And you're resuming your fast-paced life.
Okay. Satisfied the hunger, you're moving on, you go. Probably burn some of it off. What else do you tell yourself to make it okay? How many of you can eat pretty much anything you want, you don't gain weight?
Oh,
we so hate you, by the way. Yeah. Just so you know, piss us off. Sorry, I had to set you up there, knock you down. And then there are some people, they can like look at a picture of lettuce and they gain weight. I mean, and we'll talk about metabolic differences later, but we tell ourselves things, and one of the famous things that we tell ourselves is that, well, you know, if you work out or whatever, you offset some of the bad. That's one of the rationalizations, or skipping a meal, that sort of thing. So we make up excuses.
Is it true?
Hmm?
It's true, isn't it?
Is what true?
If you work out, I don't know, like the remainder of the week, was Sunday, you can eat that triple dessert.
You certainly can do any of the above. If you want to be well and you exercise to be well and then knowingly do something that is bad, you've defeated the purpose, even if the calories kind of offset.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I can tell you for sure, just in terms of eating and nutrition, if you consume a bunch of fat, fat goes in and it stays fat. It doesn't get converted to anything. Fat in is fat. It's garbage. So if you load up on a bunch of junk, the fat content is just in you, right? And common things people load up on other than like sweets and junk food, mayo, butter, slathering our food up with all that crap, horrible. Really nasty, empty, fat calories. This here about activity, this is not, oh, I have to go and do this. I like it for a variety of reasons. Not because it's prescribing, oh, you have to do this every day or this or three times a week. No, no, no. Look at this. I mentioned this before. When you're out walking your dog, given that you got to be out walking the dog anyway, why don't you try and keep up with the dog for once instead of pulling it and telling it to slow down and hang on and choking the bloody thing, right? Why don't you try and keep its pace? Get your butt moving. I like that picture. I really like this one. Able-bodied people are so full of shit. They can excuse, oh, I can't. Yeah, right. There was a guy I used to, when I was in college, I did lots of summer work doing like special events, fundraising, PR stuff for charities. One of the places I worked was the Canadian Paraplegic Association. A lot of the guys who were in wheelchairs, were they in good shape? One guy, I remember that, super friendly French-Canadian guy, and he was one of those more formal, very cordial, very friendly guys, but he always would, whenever he saw you, he'd shake your hand. Always. First thing, hey, how you doing, Troy? And I always dreaded that moment. The forearms on this guy, his upper body strength was insane, because he worked out. He didn't go to the gym, he'd pull himself out of his chair, flop his legs down, whatever, he didn't care, I'm doing benching. Hey, crazy. And then his trade, he was a carpenter. So, I mean, just great strength. Another guy, Doug Dean, he was a wheelchair basketball guy. He lived in a building that wasn't accessible. He lived on the second floor above a confectionery, above a corner store. So to get to his apartment, he would grab the banister and this wheel and just pull himself up the flight of stairs. No excuses.
What do you
mean
his chair?
Right? Then, you know.
How did he get his chair up there?
In his chair, he would grab one wheel and the banister and back himself up.
That must
have been
a bit noisy.
No one else in the building, just him living above. So,
oh, who cares?
We're all full of excuses. They're pretty thin excuses, though.
Apparently he didn't.
So, sorry.
Well, I said, what if he falls?
You know, I don't specifically remember a time. If he fell, he'd be hurt, and he'd get himself up, and away he'd go. Sorry, I just got to tell you this. It came to mind. Another guy, he was a mechanic, and his truck was having some trouble. He had to pull over, and he had to get out really fast, so he just kind of fell out of his truck. There was a bit of an engine fire, so he dragged himself along the ground. Talk about no excuses, and you just got to deal, right? Drags himself along the ground, and from underneath to put out the fire. If you know anything about people who are paralyzed, Dave had a leg bag. In other words, it's where he emptied his bladder. He used the contents of his leg bag to put out the fire. No excuses! Right? Improvise, overcome, adapt. And we sit around and go, well, I don't know. I don't know if I have time to go to the gym. I don't really feel... Shut up. I'm going. Did you know that, I don't know, probably 10, 12 minutes of intense cardio is more effective than going to the gym for 45 minutes or an hour? No, this depends on the type of training you're trying to do. But if you're just trying to get in shape and increase your cardiovascular health, you can hit it really hard, very briefly, and do yourself a lot of good. Okay. You don't have to have special equipment. You don't have to have a gym membership. You can just do some things on your own.
So, doing a very high speed around your yard is good enough.
Let's just say if you were able to do, let's just say you wanted to run around your yard once, drop down to 10 crunches or 10 push-ups, get up, run around your yard again, drop down to, and do that over and over, do it for 10 minutes straight without taking a break. Yeah, absolutely. You don't need special equipment. I'm going to show you on the next slide here some ideas about what you can do for free. this, take this as a rhetorical question you can ask yourself. What are the excuses we have? What are the excuses we have for not doing more in terms of just basic exercise? I don't have time is a very common one, but the question becomes, what does that really mean? There's no time today. You are stacked back to back to back to back to back to back, no break in bed. Get up, back to back to back to back to back, put the phone away, back to bed. Okay, is that, sorry, I had to work that in, a little redirection. Right, what does that mean? Usually it means we're shitty at time management. Things that you can do that require no special equipment at all. How many students do I see who walk to the end of this hall, wait for the elevator to go down one floor to use a skylift? You know, overall, the actual space between those floors is about 10 feet. 10 feet. Really? What's your excuse? If you have a medical reason, you got a bad heart, you got a bad knee, you're fine. Now what's your reason? I don't have time to do any exercise. Okay. What do you do while you brush your teeth? Stare at yourself in the mirror while you're brushing your teeth? Brush them like that. Get good at it, you can go down farther. And hold it. Great exercise for these things right here. You know what those muscles are good for? Burning calories. Using big muscle groups. Quadriceps. Your back. People like to work out, especially guys, they like to work out on their arms and their chest. And they forget their back. Back's a bigger muscle group. Triceps bigger than bicep. So you see these guys cranking like this. Idiots. Sorry if you're one of them. Sorry, I didn't mean to offend anybody. Squats. Now you get to laugh at me. Squatting is not just a matter of bending your knees. That would be bad. Puts lots of strain on the joint when your knees go forward, past your feet. To do a good squat, shoulder length apart. And then you assume the butt out, chest out posture. Gotta learn to do them right. You're gonna hurt yourself. Lunges, push-ups, age old, they're great. This, oh, you said you don't have to have any equipment. Can't do lateral raises, go weights. Got a grocery bag and some canned goods. No excuse. Ever do a body plank? You'll learn later that, I'll just tell you now. According to the body mass index chart, which is not necessarily the greatest thing, but I'm flirting with obesity. Me. Yeah. Okay. At my fat 41-year-old best, I was doing 3 sets of 3 minutes in body plank. Okay? So you do body plank for 3 minutes, take a break for a minute, do another one for 3 minutes, just go on the front. See how far you can get. See if you can keep up with the old man. Yeah? What's the excuse during the commercial? You got a minute, minute and a half, sometimes 2 minutes. Shit, on some channels, then he's like 5. Just bag commercial after commercial. What are you doing? Sitting there wishing the commercials would go away, texting. What are you doing? Do a body plank.
We don't have time.
Yeah, you do. Get on. So let's talk about some problems. The first thing we'll talk about is the system. Comparing, notice the list here, first world nations, I hate that distinction, but, right, places that are considered the first world. So in other words, a place with money and means. When you compare like countries in terms of financial end of things, what you find is that the U.S., compared to these countries anyway, actually ranks the lowest in life expectancy. It's not a huge difference, but it's the lowest percentage of healthcare costs paid for by the government.
No, this is not president. Yeah, it's a presidential debate tonight. We're not doing socialism, and that's not what we're talking about here. All we're saying is that in these countries, they do have a system of healthcare where the government makes a dent in healthcare costs, and they're healthier and they live longer. Call it what you want. Agree, disagree, doesn't matter. There's the data. The day you're born, here on this scale, we have life expectancy at birth. Older, younger here. Down here, we have the expenditure on health care per capita. And what you see is that folks in the States are kind of average on life expectancy, and we spend the most on health care. Seems like if we spend lots on healthcare, we should be better. Right?
Yeah.
Stand to reason, you spend more on your healthcare, you should live longer and be healthier. That's not true. All those countries have better health, longer life, and they spend less. Part of that has to do with government money and that sort of thing. But part of this, the reason why the US is way out here, we spend tons of money on basically preventable disease. A lot of the health care cost has to do with the fact that, frankly, we're fat and lazy. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we just make bad choices. And just, by the way, buried under here, I can't remember if it's under here or under here, but buried in one of those groups, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
They're healthy. Healthier, Canada. Canada rocks. We're not not tonight. No, we're not doing that. Okay, so let's talk about the choices that we make. This is just one piece of the problems that we're going to talk about. Choice is one part. Remember, there are biological and genetic realities. There are cultural realities. There are systemic realities. Tonight, because we're talking psychology, let's just look at how we think about things and why we make the choices we make. That's just, so we're just coming at it from that one part, that one angle. When we talk in psychology about health, a lot of the time we talk about this type A personality. Type A personality is generally described as people who are competitive. They tend to be kind of impatient. And some of them are the sort of hostile, aggressive type. And when you put those kind of three factors together, you get this type A personality. I am definitely a type A personality. As far as the competitiveness and the impatience, oh my goodness. I admit, I'm brutal. It seems like I'm always in a hurry. I'm not. I walk at light speed most of the time. Why? I don't know. Just gotta go. I'd rather get from A to B and get it over with than I can't. I don't know. I just, the way I think. Very type A. Very competitive. The problem with type A's, like me, like some of you, is this piece. The anger and hostility piece. You can have these two and be quite okay. You start getting into the hostile mindset, and that is what is unhealthy. You can be type B or type C. If you've got the anger and hostility, that is what they found when they do studies on people's health and their risk factor for high blood pressure, for coronary heart disease, for heart attacks. It's that anger and hostility piece that is problematic. That is what increases your risk for things like a heart attack. That would be the coronary event stuff. That anger and hostility piece is what, as it says, makes your physiological beings more reactive. It's just not good for you. So overall, in terms of your own personality, the hostility piece, I should define that for you. That anger hostility piece, these are folks who expect others to provoke them. They run around with that expectation of provocation. they also tend to be pretty cynical. They expect the worst from people. So they expect the worst from people. They're cynical. And they expect, basically, that other people are going to do bad things to them. It's also characterized by mistrust. If you got that going on, you check yourself out, because you need to get that under control. That increases the risk for these coronary events. I should tell you, I forgot to tell my other classes this, I'll tell you. There's an interesting thing about type A. Type A personality, the impatient, competitive type. Type B, more relaxed, easygoing, laid back. There's a real irony to this. People who have this type A personality are more likely to have a heart attack. It's not cause and effect. We're just saying it increases the risk. But they're also more likely to recover from the heart attack. It's like they're impatient. Like, come on, I don't have time for this shit. I got to get better. Let's go. I got to get out of here. People who are type B are less likely to have a heart attack. But if they do, they're less likely to recover. We're talking little bits of probability here. We're not talking cause and effect.
I just got a really quick question. Okay, you say that the type A people are more self-aware. What happens that happens
to the body? Stress.
Oh, it's the stress.
Absolutely. Which we'll spend more time talking about next week. Okay, here are the choices. Let's rattle through some of this because it gets kind of into statistics and stuff. And then it's dull. So let's rock and roll here. Smoking. A good stat here for you, the smokers to know. The average smoker can expect to live 13 to 14 fewer years than the average non-smoker. At this point, there's really no debate. Smoking will kill you. It is what it is. You can bullshit yourself any way you like. I say some sometimes outlandish things. There's one way that I think about it that is nasty. If you're interested and you happen to catch me outside sometime, you can ask me, and off the record, I'll tell you. It's very colorful. It's bad for you. People also don't understand about smoking that you're consuming a carcinogen, a cancer-causing agent. That means you're increasing your risk for any type of cancer, not just mouth, throat, and lung. Any type. It's in your system. Cancer-causing agents don't just pick and choose, oh, well, I went into the lungs, so I have to cause cancer in the lungs. You get toe cancer. I mean, it increases the risk. It's bad for you. Okay, enough about that. There's a healthy lung and a cooked lung. Enough about that. Stats. Sorry, and I think I gave you some blanks you got to fill in here.
Just show them that lung one more time.
Nah, we're done with the lung. It's cooked. It's bad. Not good. This is simply, these are just statistics.
Okay?
Just stats. You can show other stats and paint a rosier picture. It's just bad for you. That's it. My approach to helping people quit smoking is very, very different than what you get in most programs. Now, you can try, there are medications, other things like Zyban, you can try that. Anybody ever heard of Zyban? It's a smoking cessation drug. It's chemically identical to something called Wellbutrin. Wellbutrin is an antidepressant. It's an antidepressant that has some qualities that help people quit smoking. So if they prescribe you Zyban, they're putting you on an antidepressant. It's the same thing as Wellbutrin. And you know what that does? It comes with an added benefit. It makes you less bitchy while you try to quit. I am not kidding.
I know.
Sounds cheeky, right? I'm not making it up. Absolutely true. Zyban, Wellbutrin, same stuff. Could be potentially very bad for you. They have to check to make sure there's no history of seizures in your family. Then you're not supposed to take it. Okay, question? Oh, that medical doctor, I don't know exactly how long that black lung person was smoking. I don't know. I would imagine a very long time.
That doesn't mean that, oh, if I smoke a little bit now, I'll be okay later. No, you could be frying yourself. And just remember what's going in, right? When you inhale that, that's heated. Do you think your lungs were designed to be heated? Why don't you go, have you ever done this? Opened up your oven and kind of inhaled at the same time? It's like, oh, ooh, not because what you're cooking smells bad, but because the heat?
With cigarettes, every word that goes out there is about it's bad, it's bad. But why is he here? Why is he here? There's nothing positive about it.
Right.
And nobody.
We would have to go back in history quite a long way and have a very historical kind of discussion, which I can't do, and quite frankly, I can't do it because I don't know all of it. But I mean, the history of smoking, I mean, it's been around for a long time, and in fact, long, long, long ago, it was associated with aristocracy. I mean, people with means were the ones who were smoking. So yeah, sociological, kind of a sociological and historical account there, not going. A lot of people will try to quit. And like I said, my approach to helping people quit is very, very different. The Zyban, the meds, that sort of thing, great. You want to try them, super, patch, gum, all that stuff? Cool. But if you really want to stop smoking, and part of the reason why so many people fail, you got to come to terms with the fact that your identity includes a statement, and the statement is, I am a smoker. Part of your self-definition is that you are a smoker. Until you're prepared to change that and truly think in terms of I am a non-smoker, you won't quit. That's where I start. Then I'll give people a very simple behavioral thing to do. For smoking, I don't want you to cut back. Oh, he's using reverse psychology. No, I'm not. I don't want you to cut back. I want you to have the cigarette you plan to have. But you have to do one thing for me. Before you light it, you can sit there, you can hold it, you can do whatever you want. I want you to look at the clock and wait 1 minute. Then light it up. That's it. That's your behavioral assignment. Wait 1 minute. A huge part of the smoking problem is the sense that I don't have control. I just do it. In that 1 minute, every single time you light up, you are demonstrating that, in fact, yes, you do have control. Little bits at a time. Seems simple and goofy, but you have to start chipping away at the misconception that it's beyond your control. The identity thing is harder to deal with. It takes time. But you have to address it. It's part of the reason why I have huge problems with the whole AA model. Right? You are an alcoholic forever. You haven't had a drink in 25 years. You never get to cut that loose. You always have to define yourself. And no. My opinion on that.
What's your kind of second step after the minute pause?
Lengthen the time. When you start getting to 2 and 3 and 4 minutes of waiting, and I'm not asking you to curb cravings or deny that or just try and okay and forget it. No. If 4 minutes later, you're still thinking about it, light it up. Chances are, you will do something. You're not just going to stand there. Four bloody minutes, come on already. You'll go do something. You know what? Sometimes, you'll forget. It just starts to go away. You have to mark the time, though. You don't go, okay, he said 4 minutes, so I got 6:19. Okay. Well, I think when you get busy doing something, oh, it must have been 4 minutes by now. Aha! Is it 6:19? If it's not, you got to wait. Right? I mean, you got to be true to whatever it is, but you start lengthening your time.
What's the difference between smoking, like, and the people that chew gum or like you?
Chew and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's still in terms of the what you're getting out of it, like nicotine or the.
So you said it's the nasty
that
shit.
It's just a different way to get it. And I, to be honest with you, I haven't done a ton of study on chew, essentially. I'd have to do a little more research. Another rhetorical question. You know it's bad for you. Why do it? Okay, let's talk about booze. That's fun too, isn't it?
But you're going to leave here tonight. You didn't want us to do anything fun.
Not at all. Not at all. Did you know that alcohol contributes to 30% of all car fatalities in the U.S.?
What?
I will briefly describe what alcohol does and how it works, and later on we'll talk about specifically how it does what it does. Short-term effects, it dulls your senses and impairs your judgment. Long-term, I mean, it's cirrhosis and cancer and all sorts of nasty things. Please hear me when I say this. Do not take this literally. This is a metaphor. Okay? Alcohol, it's like it has a trickle-down effect in the brain. It doesn't literally trickle down in the brain, no. But its effect starts kind of at the top and works its way deeper into the brain. One of the first places alcohol has an effect is in your frontal lobe. So in that cortex, that top part of the brain, but up here, in the front. That front part of the brain, your frontal lobe, reasoning, planning, judgment, decision making, impulse control, sense of social inhibition, so what you should and shouldn't do socially. Alcohol is a depressant. It slows things down. So if it's affecting your frontal lobe, it's slowing down your judgment. It's slowing down your reasoning. It's slowing down your planning. It's slowing down your sense of, I shouldn't do that. Right? It's slowing down that inhibition that you'd feel. So it's slowing things down. A very common misconception is that, well, what does it make me more social and outgoing and friendly? It doesn't. It makes you less inhibited. It makes you less reserved. It makes you less quiet, because it's slowing down your better judgment. Slow down the judgment, and you go from maybe quiet or just normal to, hey, baby, what's happening? Into that blithering idiot. Right? Why? Because it slowed down your better judgment and your reasoning and your planning. That's where it starts. At the very back part of your frontal lobe, kind of at the top, that has to do with your motor behavior, your movement. There's a part in the left part of your frontal lobe that has to do with speech. So people start slurring. If the alcohol works a little deeper into your brain, it starts messing around with things in the brain that control more around impulses, emotion, movement. It gets worse. How many of you know the happy drunk? How many of you know the angry drunk? And the worst one is the weepy, sad, pissy drunk. It messes with your emotions. If it continues to work its way deeper and deeper into the brain, which is to say you're consuming a ton, for it to get down and depress stuff in the lower part of your brain, that's when things get very dangerous. Right? Very low down in the brain, basically the very top part of your spinal cord, where the spinal cord basically starts to turn into the brain, down there, kind of back in here, that's coordination of movement. That's your overall level of arousal and alert behavior, how attentive you are. And arousal, not horny arousal, just overall physiological arousal, how alert you are. Gag reflex, all your basic reflexes, cardiac reflexes, your heartbeat.
depress that enough, you're dead. Okay. So in terms of consumption of alcohol, it has that depressing effect, and it just works its way slower and then deeper and deeper in the brain. And that's why you hear that, yeah, people OD on alcohol. Teenagers get dead. They don't realize they drink very, very quickly, so it doesn't quite have enough time to start having an effect, and by the time it does start kicking in, they're obliterated, right? And sometimes, and that's part of the reason why people who drink quickly, they don't think it's a problem and they'll get in their car, right? But all that alcohol hasn't been consumed by the body yet. It's in there, it needs to be processed. As it gets processed, you're still getting drunk. So yeah, and then of course your impairment, your judgment's impaired. According to CDC, all sorts of problems here. And again, this is statistics when we're on here, so you got blanks filling in. I gotta change this PowerPoint. It's starting to annoy me. Too many stats. The first one, though, an awful lot of people meet the criteria basically for substance abuse related to alcohol. Men are more likely to be intoxicated and drunk. Increases the risk for cancer, cirrhosis of the liver. Yes, that is the way you spell cirrhosis. Interestingly enough, though, women are more vulnerable to brain damage from alcohol. They are more likely to have something called Korsakoff syndrome. You can look that up if you're interested. Yeah, it's bad for you. Okay.
Yeah, but it's so much fun.
Yeah, it's bad for you. Sorry. Sorry to rain on your parade. Man, I didn't mind. By the way, yeah, it is. Red wine. Doctors are pretty clear on this one. It can be good for your heart. It's not the alcohol. It's the extract from the red grape called resveratrol. You can get that as a supplement, no booze. Pregnant women and drinking, bad idea. I've worked with kids who have fetal alcohol effects all the way up to full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome. It ain't fun.
That's the stink.
It is bad. There is an unfortunate, again, irony. The time at which a developing embryo is most sensitive to the effects of alcohol can include the time when the woman doesn't even know she's pregnant yet. Can be in that third or fourth week. Right around the time when you start figuring it out. Well, you've been out binging and partying. Damage might already be done. Having said that, there are some women who drink through their pregnancy and their kid comes out fine. It's not cause and effect. It's sometimes the woman finds out, oh, 6 weeks, oh my God, I'm pregnant, I gotta stop everything. She stops everything. Her kid comes out with fetal alcohol effects. Well, there's no equation here. If you know you're pregnant, stop drinking.
But there's a drink called, I don't know if anybody's heard of it, the NAB drink. They claim they don't have any alcohol in it. But then on the bottom of the bottle, it has like 5% of, or 0.5% of alcohol in it. And my doctor said that was okay.
I'm in no position to argue with a practicing physician.
I mean, but do you look down at that then? I mean, I haven't tried it before, but I mean, I've heard that it's okay for a person to have a glass of wine every day.
I would say check with your doctor. Most doctors are not going to walk in and go, no, he's wrong, go ahead. But, talk to your doctor. I don't have a medical degree.
But I'm saying, do you think that that would probably cause the
The short answer is, I don't know. Specific, I again, there's no equation, so okay, we'll point X number percent every once in a while, maybe, so I don't know. No equation. This is one that I think I probably added. So this is just interesting information. So I just jot down the term binge drinking. For guys, this is medical information. This is a medical community. It's not psychological. The medical community defines binge drinking as a man consuming 5 or more drinks in one sitting once within a 2-week period. So to all the weekend warriors, you're binge drinkers. For women, it's 4 or more. In a short period of time, you're usually talking about within 2 hours, but it can be within 3. I mean, basically, if you sit down every weekend on Friday night and drink half a case of beer or something, you're a binge drinker. Absolutely. You drink a 6-pack, you're a binge drinker. According to the medical community. I'm just passing along that information. Binge drinking is worse for your health than if you had 2 drinks every night. That was not a suggestion or a recommendation. I'm simply telling you, from the medical community's perspective, binge drinking is worse for your body than having a couple drinks at night.
So that's what
So, we have this information, why don't we list? We'll talk about addiction later. That one drives me nuts. I have dealt with folks with addiction. I understand addiction. One of the problems in addiction is denial. One of the things that alcoholics will say, I drive better when I've had a few drinks.
Yeah.
I concentrate more. Do you know why you concentrate more? Because you have to try harder to concentrate because you're impaired. Nice try. No. Not sure. Bad. Another real common one is, well, I couldn't leave my car at the bar.
Why not?
Why? Well, I had to go to work the next day. You knew that when you got to the bar, dumbass. Take a cab. Well, I didn't have any money. Well, apparently I had a lot of money to drink. Right? They rationalize. They bullshit. Lots. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Right. Okay. Jacqueline Saborito, rather than show you this video, I'm going to tell you that Jackie Saborito was in a car crash. Guy named Reggie Steffi, well, 4 o'clock in the morning, driving his SUV home, and drove it head on into the car that Jackie was riding in. Two people in the car were killed instantly. Jackie was trapped in the car. She was pinned in the car, and the car was on fire. I can't remember. I think 60% of her body was covered in third-degree burns, and the cop pulled her out of the car. Parts of her were stuck to the car. Nasty. She lived.
Yeah, I didn't know.
I can't remember how many surgeries she's had. It's tons. She's on the list for a face transplant. Reggie Steffi was charged with 2 counts of intoxication manslaughter. He was convicted and sentenced to 7 years.
I knew it.
He's out.
Manslaughter?
He killed 2 people.
He was drunk. He didn't know what he was doing.
He was drunk and he killed 2 people. Yep. Interesting thing, though. I have to go back and read a lot of what I have read. Said his blood alcohol was over the legal limit. I don't know what the blood alcohol level was. If he was, you know, 0.1, or if he was 0.6, well, he'd be dead if he was 0.6. But I mean, if it, I don't know.
Should be a donor.
Can't fix stupid. All right. Overeating. Again, remember, we're talking about choices people make. With food, you know what? How many of you know somebody who's just physically large? I'm not talking fat. Not yet. They're just big. We're using the term big bone, you know. They're just large, you know, in their structure. Okay, big deal. How many of you know somebody who is overweight, but is really healthy? Right? Active, making good food choices. They're just naturally a little bit big. So what? How many of you can eat pretty much anything you want, you don't gain weight? You piss us off. Right? Right? That's not fair. That ain't right. Knock it off. You know, that genetics, we gotta look at it. Right? There are differences in metabolism. But then there are things that we do by choice. Right? If you are obese or morbidly obese by choice, that's different than if you are genetically just big. Two different stories there. This is just funny. I had to throw that in here. It's just, I'm sorry.
That doesn't even look appealing. Oh, that looks
bacon cheeseburger on a glazed donut.
Those things look diseased.
When I was 20, I'd have done that no problem. Now it just makes my teeth itch. But you know what bugs me about these pictures? This.
Oh. What alternative fuel
source? You feel your arteries clogging just looking.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that stuff burns beautifully.
The funny thing about this, you know, if you want to go eat one, knock yourself out, whatever. You got to deal with your doctor. The bottom part is what's good there. Just because you can, doesn't mean you should. That's just a good point in general, you know. I'm not picking on this kid. People, oh, it's mean. I didn't make it. It's public domain. It's on the internet. I'm borrowing it. Yeah. Maybe that kid's parents. Maybe just genetically they're big. Okay, whatever.
Is this the commercial that's on TV lately? That like that can eat better.
This is the problem. 1/7 of the world's population. 1/7. And I'll show you statistics on the states. We are there. A billion people considered overweight. And a disproportionate amount of that 1 billion are in places like the U.S.
Mm-hmm. I was reading something, and they were saying, now, okay, back a while ago, 70s, 80s, they have the weight, you know, lower, much lower than it is today, because now we can look at the scales.
Hang on.
When you look at the scales, the new ones that they put out, that, you know, like, I don't know, like, we're not going to maybe, I'm going to say, like, 5'7", her weight is probably, like, years ago, they had her down at 125, 130, you know. So that has changed.
Expectations, culture, I mean, there are a lot of things to consider. Right. When we talk about things, you know, give me a second and we'll get to where they get this obesity number from. So give me a second there. Oh, okay. Let me, and I'm also aware you need a break. I'm also aware that it's 6:55. I think there's some goofy drill, so we gotta coordinate. We gotta. They're doing it again. We gotta coordinate our break around that. So hang on.
Fire drill?
Some sort of terrorism drill.
A lockdown drill. We're not supposed to go outside.
Ray terrorism.
Okay. So this is the U.S. I've been showing this particular chart for since 2006. They updated it. I looked for 2012. I haven't found it yet. However, based on last year, Mississippi for the last 6 years running is not doing so well. Colorado for the last 6 years running is the best. I don't know if it's the altitude or what it is in Colorado. What is the problem with the South?
Fried food.
Food. Soul food. You know what? It's tasty, good food.
It is.
It's horrible for it. That's the bottom line. Well, in moderation is great, right? No problem.
It just because you, it's not, oh, well, if you live in the South, you're going to be big. No, 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 no.
I was
my
skinniest when I lived
there.
Sorry? I was my thin when I lived there.
Sure, absolutely. It's not cause and effect. It's not the South's fault, right? You know, and that's a sociocultural thing. That's about, you know, rituals and behavior around food. Okay. Yeah. Different than some of those other places. It's not good, bad, right, or wrong. It just is what it is.
It's like Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I mean, so, and that's great. Unfortunately, the food that's consumed is not necessarily the greatest for you. Again, it's like going to the buffet. You get your money's worth, but not your health's worth. That sort of idea. So, look at Minnesota. Relatively speaking, doing okay. Not great, but okay. But this is sort of the problem that's increasing right now. And some of this simply has to do with indulgence. Because you can. Here's where the numbers come from. And this, I alluded to it before, it is not particularly a great chart because all it's doing is comparing height and weight. There are lots of other factors to consider, like body type, genetic factors, cultural factors. There's more to it than just this. When you look up your height, look up your weight, and you see where you fall in the end. If you're interested, you can go online and look up the equation that they use. But healthy weight, slightly below weight, healthy weight, overweight, obese. The dark green, the whole top right kind of corner. This, so when they report statistics on obesity, they're using this. It's a crude, blunt tool that doesn't consider everything. So I'm not saying, oh, take this as gospel. Not at all. But it's a quick way, way that they use to measure.
Yeah, that's what I was getting at. Well, a lot of times they don't account for people that bodybuilders and people that...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Bodybuilding is a great example. I mean, they will be short, stocky, huge, not an ounce of body fat on them, but... You know, if you're 5'10 and you weigh 230, that puts you in the obese range. You're a bodybuilder, right? And so, yeah, it's not the best tool. So when you see statistics, you need to know what they're taking into account, right, and what they're not. So people are very quick to judge. Oh, that person's obese. Well, I hear that state's bad because they're all fat. No. That thing. Influence of time. Remember when we were talking about the definition of normal? Go all the way back to the first class. Definition of normal. It's relative. I said there's the influence of culture. There's the influence of time. Can you imagine seeing an ad like that these days? Yeah, parents all over the place suing whoever published this ad.
Hey, you hurt my daughter's feelings. Give me $6 million.
That was a normal ad in the 40s. Normal.
Chubby size.
Don't worry, we're not doing. Oh wait, hold on. Yeah, we'll just. Well, hold on. Get a little ahead of myself. So. I'm hoping that you can take away from this that there's much to consider, but our focus in terms of psychology, what are the choices that we make? What are the choices you make? How does that influence your overall level of health? And that really helps make that connection between mind and body. I realize that we need a break. I also realize that right about the time we come back from break, we're going to be interrupted. So what I would like to suggest is an extended break. Let's meet back here, and I mean this, sharp at 7, and we will hammer through the next bit. So you're getting 20 minutes. 6:55? Yeah, and then it ends quickly.
Is there any reason?
So 7 o'clock here.
Is there any reason why we can't stay put? Do they want us out?
Oh, well, they can lie. Yeah, you can turn the lights off and stay in the room if you want. I'm not going to stay in the room.
All right. You win.
So, okay. 7 o'clock, 20 minutes. Be back here.
Never been through one of these before, so.
It's about going to a safe area in the event there was some catastrophic problem out in the world. So, you know, whether that storm shell